This is part two of a three-part recording of the article on Noam Chomsky on Wikipedia. All three parts and the text article are licensed under the GNU Free Documentation license, the full text of which is available on the website. Section 6, Political Views. Chomsky is one of the best-known figures of radical American politics. He defines himself as being in the tradition of anarchism, a political philosophy he summarizes as challenging all forms of hierarchy and attempting to eliminate them if they are unjustified. He especially identifies with the labor-oriented, anarcho-syndicalist current of anarchism. Unlike many anarchists, Chomsky does not totally object to electoral politics. His stance on US elections is that citizens should vote for their local Democrat, where this will keep the Republicans out, and support more radical candidates, such as the Greens, in areas where there is no risk of letting the Republicans win. He even went so far as to officially endorse Green candidate Paul Lachelier. He has described himself as a fellow traveller to the anarchist tradition, as opposed to a pure anarchist, to explain why he is sometimes willing to engage with the state. Chomsky has also stated that he considers himself to be a conservative, presumably of the classical liberal variety. He has further defined himself as a Zionist, although he notes that his definition of Zionism is considered by most to be anti-Zionism these days, the result of what he perceives to have been a shift since the 1940s in the meaning of Zionism. In a C-SPAN Book TV interview, he stated, "I have always supported a Jewish ethnic homeland in Palestine. That is different from a Jewish state. There's a strong case to be made for an ethnic homeland, but as to whether there should be a Jewish state, or a Muslim state, or a Christian state, or a white state, that's entirely another matter." Overall, Chomsky is not fond of traditional political titles and categories, and prefers to let his views speak for themselves. His main modes of action include writing magazine articles and books, and making speaking engagements. Section 6.1, Chomsky on Terrorism. In response to US declarations of a war on terrorism in 1981 and 2001, Chomsky has argued that the major sources of international terrorism are the world's major powers, led by the United States. He uses the definition of terrorism from a US Army manual, which describes it as the calculated use of violence or the threat of violence to inculcate fear, intended to coerce or to intimidate governments or societies in the pursuit of goals that are generally political, religious, or ideological. Thus, terrorism is an objective description about certain actions, whoever their agents may be. As he notes in relation to the US invasion of Afghanistan, wanton killing of innocent civilians is terrorism, not a war against terrorism. On the efficiency of terrorism, he says, "One is the fact that terrorism works. It doesn't fail, it works. Violence usually works, that's world history. Secondly, it's a very serious analytical error to say, as is commonly done, that terrorism is the weapon of the weak. Like other means of violence, it's primarily a weapon of the strong, overwhelmingly, in fact. It is held to be a weapon of the weak because the strong also control the doctrinal systems, and their terror doesn't count as terror. Now, that's close to universal. I can't think of a historical exception. Even the worst mass murderers view the world that way. So take the Nazis. They weren't carrying out terror in occupied Europe. They were protecting the local population from the terrorisms of the partisans. And like the other resistance movements, that there was terrorism. The Nazis were carrying out counter-terror." As regards support for or condemnation of terrorism, Chomsky opines that terrorism and violence authority in general are generally bad and can only be justified in those cases where it is clear that greater terrorism or violence or abuse of authority is thus avoided. Chomsky considers that terrorism, as defined in the US Army manual, carried out by the US government, does not pass this test, and condemnation of it is one of the main thrusts of his writings. He's also skeptical that other acts of terrorism pass the test, and has thus condemned such things as the Khmer Rouge terror in Cambodia, the attacks on the Twin Towers in New York, and similar acts. Chomsky's reaction to the September 11, 2001 attacks on New York and Washington, D.C. were widely criticized from people on different sides of the political spectrum. One critic was the author and journalist Christopher Hitchens. In an exchange between the two, Hitchens also said that Chomsky's opposition to military action in Afghanistan, coupled with his portrayal of NATO military action in the Balkans as naked aggression and persecution of the Serbs, as evidence that Chomsky was in fact soft on terrorism and fascism. He also characterized Chomsky's comparison between Al-Qaeda's attacks and the 1998 bombing of a Sudanese pharmaceutical facility as a form of moral equivalence. In fact, Chomsky argued that the consequences rather than the moral intent might be comparable. According to Chomsky, Hitchens condemns the claim of facile moral equivalence between two crimes. Fair enough, but since he fabricated the claim out of thin air, I feel no need to comment. Section 2.6. Criticism of United States government. Chomsky has been a consistent and outspoken critic of the United States government, and criticism of the foreign policy of the United States has formed the basis of much of Chomsky's political writing. Chomsky focuses on the United States for two reasons. First, he believes that his work can have more impact when directed at his own government. And second, the United States is the world's sole remaining superpower, and so, Chomsky believes, it acts in the same offensive ways as all superpowers. However, Chomsky will criticize official enemies like the former Soviet Union in passing. One of the key things superpowers do, Chomsky argues, is try to organize the world around themselves using military and economic means. Thus, the US government bombed Vietnam in the Vietnam War and the larger Indochina conflict for daring to break away from the US economic system. He has also criticized US interference in Central and South American countries and military support of Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. Chomsky has repeatedly emphasized his theory that much of the United States foreign policy is based on the threat of a good example, which he says is another name for the domino theory. The threat of a good example is that a country could successfully develop outside the US sphere of influence, thus presenting a model for other countries, including countries in which the United States has strong economic interests. This, Chomsky says, has prompted the United States to repeatedly intervene to quell independent development, regardless of ideology, in regions of the world where it has no inherent economic or safety interests. In one of his most famous works, What Uncle Sam Really Wants, Chomsky uses this particular theory as an explanation for the United States' interventions in Guatemala, Laos, Nicaragua, and Grenada. Chomsky believes the US government's Cold War policies were not entirely shaped by anti-Soviet paranoia, but rather towards preserving the United States' ideological and economic dominance in the world. As he wrote in Uncle Sam, what the US wants is stability, meaning security for the upper classes and large foreign enterprises. While he is almost uniformly critical of United States government's foreign policy, Chomsky expresses his admiration for the freedom of expression enjoyed by US citizens in a number of interviews and books. According to Chomsky, other Western democracies such as France and Canada are less liberal in their defense of controversial speech than US. However, he does not credit the American government for giving freedoms, but rather the long history of mass movements in the United States that fought for them. He is also sharply critical of any government suppression of free speech. Section 6.3. Views on corporate-sponsored globalization. Chomsky made early efforts to critically analyze corporate-sponsored globalization. He summarized the process with the phrase, old wine, new bottles, maintaining that the motives of elites are the same as always. They seek to isolate the general population from important decision-making processes, the difference being that the centers of power are now transnational corporations and supranational banks. Chomsky argues that transnational corporate power is developing its own governing institutions, reflective of their global reach. According to Chomsky, a primary ploy has been the co-optation of the global economic institutions established after World War II. The key Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, have increasingly adhered to the Washington Consensus, which requires needy countries to undertake harsh structural adjustments, including cutbacks on social programs and government expenditure that protects the poor, in order to qualify for international loans and development aid. Specific forms of financial and trade liberalization are also imposed on developing countries. Chomsky claims the construction of global institutions and agreements, such as the World Trade Organization, GATT, NAFTA, and the MAI, constitute new ways of securing elite privileges while undermining democracy. Chomsky describes how neoliberal measures ensure that the nations of the global south continue to fulfill their traditional service role by providing cheap labor, raw materials, and investment opportunities for the first world. Additionally, this means that corporations can threaten to relocate to poorer countries, and Chomsky sees this as a powerful weapon to keep workers in richer countries in line. Chomsky has been keen to point out the limitations of terms used in discourse on globalization, beginning with the term globalization itself, which is used to refer to a specific form of elite-sponsored international economic integration, rather than being a general term for things becoming international. He dislikes the term anti-globalization being used to describe what he regards as a movement for globalization of social and environmental justice. Chomsky understands what is popularly called free trade as a mixture of liberalization and protection designed by the principal architects of policy in the service of their interests, which happen to be whatever they are in any particular period. In his writings, Chomsky has drawn attention to popular resistance to globalization. He described Zapatista defiance of NAFTA in his essay, The Zapatista Uprising. He also criticized the multinational agreement on investment and reported on the activist efforts that led to its defeat. Chomsky's voice was an important part of a growing chorus of critics, provided the theoretical backbone for the disparate groups who united for the groundbreaking demonstrations against the World Trade Organization in Seattle in November of 1999. Section 6.4, Views on Socialism. Chomsky is deeply opposed to what he calls corporate state capitalism, practiced by the United States and its allies. He supports many of Mikhail Bakunin's anarchist or libertarian socialist ideas, requiring economic freedom in addition to the control of production by the workers themselves, not owners and managers who rule them and control all the decisions. He refers to this as real socialism and describes Soviet-style socialism as similar in terms of totalitarian controls to US-style capitalism, saying that each is a system based in types and levels of control, rather than in organization or efficiency. In defense of this thesis, Chomsky sometimes points out that Frederick Winslow Taylor's philosophy of scientific management was the organizational basis for the Soviet Union's massive industrialization movement, as well as the American corporate model. Chomsky has illuminated Bakunin's comments on the totalitarian state as predictions for the brutal Soviet police state that would come. He echoes Bakunin's statement that, if you took the most ardent revolutionary, vested him in absolute power, within a year he would be worse than the Tsar himself, which expands upon the idea that the tyrannical Soviet state was simply a natural growth from the Bolshevik ideology of state control. He has also termed Soviet communism as fake socialism, and said that contrary to what many in America claim, the collapse of the Soviet Union should be regarded as a small victory for socialism, not capitalism. In his 1973 book, For Reasons of State, Chomsky argues that instead of a capitalist system in which people are wage slaves, or an authoritarian system in which decisions are made by a centralized committee, a society could function with no paid labor. He argues that a nation's populace should be free to pursue jobs of their choosing. People will be free to do as they like, and the work they voluntarily choose will be both rewarding in itself and socially useful. Society would be run under a system of peaceful anarchism, with no state or government institutions. Work that was fundamentally distasteful to all, if any existed, would be distributed equally among everyone. Though highly critical of the Soviet state in Russia, during the 1960s and 70s, Chomsky was more positive in his assessment of grassroots communist movements in Asia. In a 1968 essay, Objectivity and Liberal Scholarship, Chomsky praised the grassroots aspects of the Chinese and Vietnam communist revolutions, noting certain similar features with the Spanish anarchist movement of the 1930s, which he greatly admires, while at the same time cautioning that the scale of the Chinese Revolution is so great and reports in depth are so fragmentary that it would no doubt be foolhardy to attempt a general evaluation. In December 1967, while participating in a forum in New York, he said that in China one finds many things that are really quite admirable, and that China is an important example of a new society in which very interesting and positive things happened at the local level, in which a good deal of the collectivization and communization was really based on mass participation and took place after a level of understanding had been reached in the peasantry that led to this next step. Similarly, in a speech given in Hanoi on the 13th of April 1970 and broadcast by Radio Hanoi on the 14th of April 1970, Chomsky spoke of his admiration for the people of Vietnam who have been able to defend themselves against the ferocious attack and, at the same time, take great strides forward toward the socialist society. In later years, however, Chomsky expressed criticisms of the Chinese communist state that were consistent with his anarchist perspectives. In an essay written in the year 2000, Millennial Visions and Selective Vision, he referred to China's totalitarian regime and described the starvation of 25 to 40 million people during the 1958 to 1961 famines caused by the Great Leap Forward, not widely known until after Mao's death, as a terrible atrocity. Section 6.5, Mass Media Analysis. Another focus of Chomsky's political work has been an analysis of mainstream mass media, especially in the United States, its structures and constraints, and its perceived role in supporting big business and government interests. Edward S. Herman and Chomsky's book Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media, explores this topic in depth, presenting their propaganda model of the news media with numerous detailed case studies demonstrating it. According to this propaganda model, more democratic societies like the US use subtle, non-violent means of control, unlike totalitarian systems, where physical force can readily be used to coerce the general population. In an oft-quoted remark, Chomsky states that propaganda is to democracy what the bludgeon is to a totalitarian state. The model attempts to explain this perceived systemic bias of the mass media in terms of structural economic causes rather than a conspiracy of people. It argues the bias derives from five filters that all published news must pass through, which combine to systematically distort news coverage. The first filter, ownership, notes that most major media outlets are owned by large corporations. The second, funding, notes that the outlets derive the majority of their funding from advertising, not readers. Thus, since they are profit-oriented businesses selling a product, readers and audiences, to other businesses, advertisers, the model would expect them to publish news which would reflect the desires and values of those businesses. 3. In addition, the news media are dependent on government institutions and major businesses with strong biases as sources for much of their information. FLAC, the fourth filter, refers to various pressure groups which go after the media for supposed bias and so on when they go out of line. Norms, the fifth filter, refer to the common conceptions shared by those in the profession of journalism. Note, in the original text published in 1988, the fifth filter was anti-communism. However, with the fall of the Soviet Union, it has been broadened to allow for shifts in public opinion. The model describes how the media form a decentralized and non-conspiratorial, but nevertheless very powerful propaganda system that is able to mobilize an elite consensus, frame public debate within elite perspectives, and at the same time give the appearance of democratic consent. Chomsky and Herman test their model empirically by picking paired examples, pairs of events that were objectively similar except for the alignment of domestic elite interests. They use a number of such examples to attempt to show that in cases where an official enemy does something, like murder of a religious official, the press investigates thoroughly and devotes a great amount of coverage to the matter. But when the domestic government or an ally does the same thing, or worse, the press downplays the story. They also test their model against the case that is often held up as the best example of a free and aggressively independent press, the media coverage of the Tet Offensive during the Vietnam War. Even in this case, they argue that the press was behaving subserviently to elite interests. Critics of Chomsky and Herman's mass media analysis, including author and historian Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution, severely disagree with Chomsky and Herman's theories. They see the idea of manufacturing consent as nothing more than a recycling of the Marxist idea of false consciousness, in which the masses have been so manipulated that they have neither the perspective or intellect to see beyond the propaganda, and require superior intellects like Chomsky's to point out to them the real truth. Arch Puddington of the Hoover Institution also claims he sees virtually no empirical evidence in media coverage, specifically regarding the mass media's treatment of Cambodia and East Timor, to back the claims made in manufacturing consent. Stephen J. Morris, a critic of Chomsky's position on Cambodia, evaluates Herman and Chomsky's propaganda model by reviewing their analysis of media coverage during the rule of the Khmer Rouge. Chomsky and Herman argue that the flood of rage and anger directed against the Khmer Rouge, peaking in early 1977, was a concrete example of their propaganda model in action. They argue that the media was singling out Cambodia, an enemy of the United States, while underreporting human rights abuses by American allies such as South Korea and Chile. Sharp points to a study performed by Jamie Frederick Metzl, Responses to Human Rights Abuses in Cambodia, 1975-1980, analyzing major media reporting on Cambodia, in which Metzl concludes that media coverage on Cambodia was more intense when there were events with an international angle, but had largely disappeared by 1977. Metzl also contradicts Chomsky and Herman by claiming that of all the articles published regarding Cambodia, less than 1 in 20 dealt with the political violence being perpetrated by the Khmer Rouge. Section 6.6. Chomsky and the Middle East. Chomsky grew up in the Jewish Zionist cultural tradition. His father was one of the foremost scholars of the Hebrew language and taught at a religious school. Chomsky has also had a long fascination with and involvement with left-wing Zionist politics. As he described, "I was deeply interested in Zionist affairs and activities, or what was then called Zionist, though the same ideas and concerns are now called anti-Zionist. I was interested in socialist binationalist options for Palestine, and in the kibbutzim and the whole cooperative labor system that had developed in the Jewish settlement there, the Yishuv. The vague ideas I had at the time, in 1947, were to go to Palestine, perhaps to a kibbutz, and try to become involved in efforts at Arab-Jewish cooperation within a socialist framework. opposed to the deeply anti-democratic concept of a Jewish state, a position that was considered well within the mainstream of Zionism. He is highly critical of the policies of Israel towards the Palestinians and its Arab neighbors. Among many articles and books, his book The Fateful Triangle is considered one of the main texts among those who oppose Israeli treatment of the Palestinians and American support for Israeli government policies. He has also condemned Israel's role in guiding state terrorism by selling weapons to apartheid South Africa and Latin American countries that he characterizes as US puppet states, for example Guatemala in the 1980s, as well as US-backed right-wing paramilitaries, or according to Chomsky, terrorists, such as the Nicaraguan Contras. In addition, he has consistently condemned the United States for its military, financial, and diplomatic support of successive Israeli governments. Chomsky characterizes Israel as a mercenary state, an Israeli Sparta, a militarized dependency within the US system of hegemony. He has also fiercely criticized sectors of the American Jewish community for their role in obtaining unconditional US support, stating that they should be more properly called the supporters of the moral degeneration and ultimate destruction of Israel. He says of the ADL, or Anti-Defamation League, "The leading official monitor of anti-Semitism, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, interprets anti-Semitism as unwillingness to conform to its requirements with regard to support for Israeli authorities. The logic is straightforward. Anti-Semitism is opposition to the interests of Israel, as the ADL sees them. The ADL has virtually abandoned its earlier role as a civil rights organization, becoming one of the main pillars of Israeli propaganda in the US, as the Israeli press casually describes it, engaged in surveillance, blacklisting, compilation of FBI-style files circulated adherents for the purpose of defamation, angry public responses to criticism of Israeli actions, and so on. These efforts, buttressed by insinuations of anti-Semitism or direct accusations, are intended to deflect or undermine opposition to Israeli policies, including Israel's refusal, with US support, to move towards a general political settlement." Section 7. Chomsky's influence as a political activist. Section 7.1. Opposition to the Vietnam War. Chomsky became one of the most prominent opponents of the Vietnam War in February 1967, with the publication of his essay, The Responsibility of Intellectuals, in the New York Review of Books. Alan J. Matusow, in his book The Vietnam War, The Liberals and the Overthrow of LBG. By 1967, the radicals were obsessed by the war and frustrated by their impotence to affect its course. The government was unmoved by protest, the people were uninformed and apathetic, and American technology was tearing Vietnam apart. What then was their responsibility? Noam Chomsky explored this problem in February 1967 in the New York Review, which had become the favorite journal of the radicals. By virtue of their training and leisure, intellectuals had a greater responsibility than ordinary citizens for the actions of the state, Chomsky said. It was their special responsibility to speak the truth and expose lies. Chomsky concluded by quoting an essay written 20 years before by Dwight MacDonald, an essay that implied that in time of crisis, exposing lies might not be enough. Only those who are willing to resist authority themselves when it conflicts too intolerably with their personal moral code, MacDonald had written, only they have the right to condemn. Chomsky's article was immediately recognized as an important intellectual event. Along with the radical students, radical intellectuals were moving from protest to resistance. End of quotation. A contemporary reaction from Razil Abilson, chairman of the Department of Philosophy at New York University, is, "Chomsky's morally impassioned and powerfully argued denunciation of American aggression in Vietnam and throughout the world is the most moving political document I have read since the death of Leon Trotsky. It is inspiring to see a brilliant scientist risk his prestige, his access to lucrative government grants, and his reputation for Olympian objectivity by taking a clear-cut, no-holds-barred adversary position on the burning moral political issue of the day." End of quotation. Chomsky also participated in resistance activities, which he described in subsequent essays and letters published in the New York Review of Books. These were withholding half of his income tax, taking part in the 1967 march on the Pentagon, and spending a night in jail. In the spring of 1972, Chomsky testified on the origins of the war before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, chaired by J. William Fulbright. Section 7.2. Marginalization in the mainstream media. Despite Chomsky's prominence during the Vietnam War, after the end of the war, Chomsky became increasingly marginalized by the mainstream media in the US. Chomsky's supporters, who regard him as a dissident, often criticize his marginalization. For example, Milan Rai has suggested that the controversy over Chomsky's 1979 comments on the Khmer Rouge was manufactured as part of a propaganda campaign to discredit Chomsky. In 1979, Paul Robinson wrote in the New York Times Book Review, "Judged in terms of the power, range, novelty, and influence of his thought, Noam Chomsky is arguably the most important intellectual alive today." However, Robinson goes on to describe Chomsky's political writings as maddeningly simple-minded. A 1995 Boston Globe profile by Anthony Flint, Divided Legacy, described Chomsky's increasing marginalization. The New York Review of Books was one soapbox for Chomsky, but only until 1972 or so. Chomsky says that's because the magazine's editorial policy abruptly shifted to the right around then. But he couldn't seem to find a home with other publications either. He went from huddling with newspaper editors and bouncing ideas off them to being virtually banned. The New Republic wouldn't have him, in part because of his unrelenting criticism of Israel. The Nation, occasionally. But for the most part, mainstream outlets shunned him. Today his articles on social and political developments are confined to lesser-known journals such as the magazine Z. End of quotation. More succinctly, Paul Berman wrote in Terror and Liberalism, "In the United States, the principal newspapers and magazines have tended to ignore Chomsky's political writings for many years now because of his reputation as a crank." Since Chomsky's 9/11 became a bestseller in the aftermath of the September 11, 2001 attacks, Chomsky has been getting more coverage from the mainstream American media. For example, the New York Times published an article in May 2002 describing the popularity of 9/11. In January 2004, The Times published a review of Chomsky's Hegemony or Survival by Samantha Power, and in February, The Times published an op-ed by Chomsky himself, criticizing the Israeli West Bank barrier for taking Palestinian land. Section 7.3, Worldwide Audience. Despite Chomsky's marginalization in the mainstream US media, Chomsky is one of the most globally famous figures of the left, especially among academics and university students, and frequently travels across the United States, Europe, and the Third World. He has a very large following of supporters worldwide, as well as a dense speaking schedule, drawing large crowds wherever he goes. He is often booked up to 2 years in advance. He was one of the main speakers at the 2002 World Social Forum. He is interviewed at length in alternative media. Many of his books are bestsellers, including 9/11. The 1992 film Manufacturing Consent, shown widely on college campuses and broadcast on PBS, gave Chomsky a younger audience. In a 1995 article in Revelation, Alex Burns described the film as a double-edged sword. It brought Chomsky's work to a wider audience and made it accessible, yet it has also been used by younger activists to idolize him, creating a cult of personality. Chomsky's popularity has become a cultural phenomenon. Bono of U2 called Chomsky a rebel without a pause, the Elvis of academia. Rage Against the Machine took copies of his books on tour with the band. Pearl Jam ran a small pirate radio on one of their tours, playing Chomsky talks mixed along with their music. REM asked Chomsky to go on tour with them and open their concerts with a lecture. He declined. Chomsky lectures have been featured on the B-sides of records from Chumbawamba and other groups. Many anti-globalization and anti-war activists regard Chomsky as an inspiration. Chomsky is widely read outside the US. 9/11 was published in 26 countries and translated into 23 foreign languages. It was a bestseller in at least 5 countries, including Canada and Japan. Outside the US, the mainstream media give Chomsky's views considerable coverage. In the UK, for example, he appears frequently on the BBC. End of part 2 of 3. See part 3 for criticisms of Chomsky's political ideas. All three parts are licensed under the GNU Free Documentation License. See the website for further details.